As many of the other speakers have said today, it's a tremendous pleasure and privilege to be with this group today. It's always wonderful to come to this meeting. I learn a lot from the other scientists that speak, and I learn a lot from the patients that I meet every time I come, and I'm going to give you some examples of that today. I'm also always struck by, you can turn this thing way down, I spent the first 15 years of my life in the principal's office because of the volume of my voice. But I'm also struck by the number of speakers that commented today with some version of, I wouldn't be here today were it not for the FFB. My work wouldn't be here today if not for the FFB. This field wouldn't be here today if not for the FFB. I think people probably heard that 10 or 12 times today. And this is also true for what I want to talk to you about, which is a certain strategy for delivering genetic testing to the whole country, basically. And our group started this work, this version of this work. A lot of people are interested in genetic testing. A lot of people do genetic testing. But our group started this work 15 years ago, not really realizing that we were starting this work. And what I mean by that is we were just out, like a lot of other people, trying to find genes that cause disease. And I was under the impression that that was our job, and that if we put one of these genes in a journal someplace, that there would be some genetic testing company that would swoop in and pick this up and deliver it, and a year or two later, somebody who lived in Dothan, Alabama, could be tested for this thing, and we'd move on, find some other genes. And you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years into this, it started weighing on me that was not happening, that some of the genes that had been found even in the late 80s were not available to people for genetic testing. And we started investigating that. And I want to talk to you a little bit about what we concluded after 5 or 6 years of working on this pretty hard. And I've divided my remarks today really into 3 parts. And I'll tell you what the parts are, and you can kind of try to figure out as I go through which part I'm in. Okay? So the first part is to sort of come off of Tim's talk and all of the other talks that you heard today, where you heard about this tremendously exciting stuff on several different channels. And I want to introduce the idea that genetic testing is the mortar that holds the bricks of these discoveries together and really makes them all one thing. So it isn't that genetic testing is a thing, a channel all by itself, but it's really the thing that makes a lot of these other things meaningful. It makes them work, and I'm going to try to make that point to you today. Then I want to spend a few minutes sort of telling you about the model that we've come up with for trying to deliver large-scale, affordable genetic testing in a way that people feel good about. Buried in that part, somebody wrapped that guy's knuckles with a ruler. Mitts off the volume control. I keep backing up, you know, but it's on my tie. I can't get away from the microphone. So in the middle of the part of my talk where I'm telling you how this genetic testing model works, I've got a cool announcement buried in there. That'll be evident when that happens. And then the last part, I want to tell you about 3 things that I learned over the last 24 hours talking to patients. And I must admit, I sort of knew about these things a little bit, but as it always happens when I talk to patients, something that I knew sort of fuzzily becomes crystal clear when seen through the eyes of the patients or the family members that are affected. And buried in this part, I'm going to disclose the existence of a secret weapon. I'm going to tell you about the secret weapon. Okay, so the main take-home message for those of you listening at home on the cassette version of this program is that, in my view, genetic testing is the key, the remaining key, to the development of clinical trials, effective clinical trials for inherited eye diseases. And he said, how could that be? I mean, surely the key has got to be finding other genes or the vectors or some kind of gizmo. I mean, surely that's got to be the key. And I'm here to tell you, I don't think that's the key. I think it's widespread, affordable genetic testing. It isn't that these other things aren't important, but these other things have ceased because of the activities of the people in this room and all the progress that's been made. The other things have ceased being the bottleneck, and the bottleneck has become this genetic testing business. I'm going to tell you about that a little bit. So why is genetic testing a big deal? What are the roles of genetic testing? Well, a lot of the diseases we're interested in are heterogeneous, either genetically heterogeneous, meaning caused by a bunch of different genes, or also mechanistically heterogeneous. They look similar to clinicians, but they're really caused by fundamentally different processes. And if that's true, then no treatment is going to work for all of them. And so despite the fact that most drug company folks stay at home at night wishing a treatment's going to work for all of them, they're not going to work for all of them. Just like one antibiotic's not going to work for all forms of infectious disease, one cancer treatment's not going to work for all forms of cancer. One treatment is not going to work for all forms of retinal degeneration. And so we're going to need to be able, ultimately, to match a treatment to the disease, just like we match an antibiotic to an infection. And the ability to do that will take any existing treatment we have, anyone, either one that's being developed now or one we've already got, and make it better. It's like those BASF commercials, you know, we don't make the lawn furniture, we make it better. Well, genetic testing, in most cases, doesn't make the treatment. It makes the treatments we have better, because if there is a genetic subtype, for example, of macular degeneration that does terrible with thermal laser, and there must be one of those out there, because I can tell you some of the patients we treat with laser do terrible, and some of them do great. And if we knew which ones did great and which ones did terribly and didn't have to find that out after the fact, it would take our existing 20-year-old treatment and make it better. So another thing that genetic testing will let us do is it will let us study large populations of patients and with specific mutations and figure out what clinicians like to call the natural history of the disease, meaning left alone, what does this do? I mean, over what period of time do you lose vision? You know, what are the kinetics of this and so forth? And I'm going to expound upon this a little bit, but suffice it to say, you have to know this to know when during the disease to intervene and when to assess the patients. And when you're trying to, if you're a drug company and you think you've only got about 4 or 5 years to figure out whether this drug works or not, where in that natural history you choose to try out your drug is going to be the difference between a trial that worked and a trial that didn't work. Similarly, in clinical trials, if there are any sort of genetic factors that affect the response to treatment and you don't know about them, all that does is add noise to the trial. It just puts a whole bunch of people that do unexpectedly bad or people that do unexpectedly good because of these variables into your trial, and you need a larger N to figure it out. And if you can somehow with genetic testing figure out these ones that have a very predictable natural history, then you can find out whether your drug works or not with a smaller N in a shorter period of time. And then the all-time number one winning reason to use genetic testing for something is you can treat the disease before it occurs. Pre-symptomatic treatment. So think about that. You know, if you're sitting there and you've got a big old scar the size of an ashtray in the back of your eye and we're trying to figure out what sort of intervention is going to fix that, think about what kind of intervention that would have to be as opposed to being able to predict that that would occur 30 years before it happens and you know what the mechanism of that disease is, what kind of efficacy would you need to maybe just get in there and limit that a little bit? You say, well, come on, that's rocket science. Give me an example of something like that. Well, how about scurvy? Scurvy used to kill people all the time, okay, because you didn't have vitamin C, and your teeth would fall out, and you'd bleed to death because you didn't have connective tissue, and then, you know, you figure out that you have to take some citrus fruit on your long voyages, and suddenly that disease is just gone. Okay, so there are ways, if you understand the mechanism of a disease, to get in there in front of it and prevent it from happening. And I think specifically for extremely prevalent diseases like age-related macular degeneration, we better hope we can come up with some way to prevent at least half of it, because in the next 20 years, we're going to have a doubling of the amount of it with our aging of the population. So if we end up preventing half of it, we're going to have just as much of it 25 years from now as we have today. So that's a sobering thought, but I think the genetics is going to be the thing that helps us with that. So let's consider a new patient getting diagnosed with Leber's congenital amaurosis in 2006, blindness and birth. This baby is about 6 months old. The parents have figured out that their child is not seeing, and they're terrified, and they're in the ophthalmologist's office. And what do you think 90% of families are told in that circumstance? What? Okay, so what was said is, you've got to live with it. Now, what is that would be a gentle way to say it. How do they usually say it? There is nothing we can do. It's the first thing out of their mouth. And I know, I have to say that I think 100% of patients that I see with a retinal degeneration recount to me their experience with having been told that there is nothing we can do. And I tell the residents at our place that, you know, there's really no uglier thing than you can say to another human being than that. And I say, maybe there's nothing you can do. This person needs a doctor. You know? And what do you mean by that? You know, I know we can't do surgery or give the person medicine to just fix this problem right now, but that does not mean there is nothing we can do. We can sit in there and talk about some of the exciting stuff that we heard about today. And somebody says, well, I don't want to give that person false hope. Oh, heaven forbid that we might give the person some hope. Let's just take this little Louisville slugger out we've got and just beat them with it a little bit, you know? I mean, it's just unbelievable. Don't want to oversell anything. You know, we've only got $600 million worth of vision research in this country a year. We don't want to tell anybody about any of that. Well, you know, so some of you, there's a big stack of these cards out at the desk out there, and if you don't have one yet, please get one. This is a card that has the URL for this genetic testing thing, and we came up with a little motto for this outfit that we say, there is something you can do. There is something you can do. And the point of this is to just say, now look, if this were me, you know, what would I want? Well, I'd want somebody to talk to me about it. I'd want somebody to give me some hope and so forth. But let me just tell you, I didn't know this 15 years ago, but over the years, because I do this sort of work for a living, there is a whole different message that you send to a patient when after you discuss what the diagnosis is and whatever, you say, now look, we're going to go into the other room and we're going to get a blood sample, okay, and we're going to send that off to find out blah, 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 right? Well, that is a whole different message than saying you don't need to come back here. Okay, we're going to refer you back to your general person orbiting out beyond the asteroid belt, you know. We don't need to see you back here. No, we're going to draw blood from you because we are part of a big international organization of scientists working together to try to cure your disease. And we're going to try to connect you to that organization through finding out the molecular underpinning of what you've got. And that makes a big impact on somebody. Somebody is doing something when they do that. And I'm not suggesting that genetic testing is the only thing you could do. I listed the other ones. Counseling, sitting there talking to the person for an hour. Those are real important things, talking about research. But this is an important one, too, because if you are fortunate enough to find the specific cause of this person's disease at the molecular level, it is the universal language that lets the patient know where in this big constellation of research stuff they fit. And people want to know that. I mean, if you have RPE65 associated Leber's congenital amaurosis, you're going to be a little bit more focused on that than something else. And that's just normal. That's what anybody would do. And people want to know that. You'd want to know that if you sit and think about it. So we want to stop telling people there's nothing we can do. And the reason, you know, I thought about, like, why would these doctors who are other, you know, they're spending their whole lives trying to help people, and they went to medical school and all this stuff, why do they do this heinous thing when the one person who comes in that day that needs more kindness and care and gentleness than anybody else in the room, you know, the person right before them, they're sitting in there, they got diagrams about how the cataract comes out, and they're showing, you know, movies of how they hold their hands and everything, all this stuff. And then the labor's congenital amaurosis kid, there's nothing we can do. You know, why is that? It's because there isn't anything they can do. We have not given that person in Dothan, Alabama, a system whereby he or she can just order the thing. We've had it in our academic centers for, you know, 10 or 15 years, but the person out there in the community doesn't have that. So 90% of the people, so let me just tell you why that applies to the people in this room. 90% of the people that we want to participate in a clinical trial aren't being taken care of by anybody right now. They got sent home about 15 years ago, and they got over it, and they're going on with their lives, and they're not sitting in this room. They don't get the FFB mailings. They don't tear off the little form on the back and send in a little donation. They're sampling in my lab. It isn't in Steve Dager's lab. It isn't in anybody's lab. So if we're trying to find genes, 90% of the people aren't part of this effort. And I don't think we can afford to just give up 90% of the people at the get-go for this effort. I think we need to engage 90% of the people. So let's stop telling people there's nothing we can do. Let's talk about this concept of gene-directed therapy. What is that? Well, the concept of gene-directed therapy is any kind of therapy that uses the knowledge of a gene to assist it. So true gene therapy would be a form of gene-directed therapy. Have the gene replace it as part of the treatment. Understanding the mechanism of a disease and sorting the patients into different mechanistic groups would be a form of gene-directed therapy. So what are the steps for gene-directed therapy? Find the genes, figure out which mutations cause disease and which ones don't, develop animal models, treat the animal models with some kind of treatment until one works, go out in the population, find human beings that have what the animals had, enroll those people in the trials, so you have the greatest likelihood that the thing is going to work. And then when you've proven efficacy in that smaller group, then try to generalize it. Those are the steps. And I think you've heard all those steps today. You've heard that happening all over the place. And then the one missing part, or the one part that I think is sort of sissy and weak-kneed in 2006, is the genetic testing thing. So the announcement that I was going to tell you, buried in here, is I am extremely pleased to tell you today that a family who lives in Iowa, in southeastern Iowa, has decided in the past several weeks to give us $5 million to help do this. And so two of the family members are named John and Marcia Carver, and so the effort is going to be called the John and Marcia Carver Nonprofit Genetic Testing Laboratory. And because they are the great organization that they are, and because they recognize that this is central to their mission, the Foundation Fighting Blindness decided to contribute $1.2 million to the effort, so we have a total of $6.2 million to try to solve this problem. And so just like all the other speakers today have made the point of how tremendously appreciative they are of what the FFB has done, I want to add my appreciation to Gordon and to Steve Rose and to everybody who was involved in making the decision to do this. And I also want to make the point that in my view, although this money will be used to help support this laboratory that's physically in Iowa, the samples don't all come from Iowa. They come from this whole community. And so these gifts are really gifts to the community that is sitting in this room to try to solve this problem that's really been a chronic problem for us. So now I just want to emphasize a couple of points that I've already touched on, but I want to make them explicit now, about how genetic testing would help the conduct of a clinical trial, of any kind of clinical trial. The two things I want to introduce are mechanistic heterogeneity and optimal timing. Those are the two points, mechanistic heterogeneity and optimal timing. So let's just take the simplest case, Leber's congenital amaurosis caused by a bunch of different genes, and let's say some investigators have got an RPE65 gene replacement therapy working great in a dog model, which they do. Will that treatment work in a child that has guanylate cyclase-associated Leber's congenital amaurosis? No. No. So it would just, the surgery would potentially harm the retina a little bit, and it would not make the retina better. So in order to do a clinical trial and test whether this works, you must have effective genetic testing to find patients whose disease is based upon the absence of the RPE65 gene. That's the mechanistic heterogeneity one. There are examples like that for drug-based trials as well. The less obvious one, which I touched on earlier, but again, I want to make explicit here, is the optimal timing thing. Let's just imagine a disease. It could be any disease affecting one of the families in this room, in which you start off and you have normal vision, and then you start losing your vision a little bit, and then it falls for a while, and then it sort of plateaus after you've lost what you're going to lose. And whether you're no light perception when it plateaus, or whether you're 2200 from age-related macular degeneration, whatever, there's this curve that sort of falls for a while and then plateaus. Lots of diseases do that. So let's say somebody's got a drug that's working great in a cell model or in an animal model or something like that, and again, Jerry Cagle comes in, excuse me, Jerry, for mentioning you. He comes in and he says, look, we got 4 years, okay? You show me this thing works and we can make a product out of it. You have four, count them, 4 years, and if you can't do that, this thing is dead. Okay? So what do you want to do? Let's say this disease progresses over 25 years. You've got about, 10 years of nothing up here in the good part. You've got 6 or 7 years of this fallen thing, and then you got the rest of your life down here at the bottom part. Well, what would happen if you rounded up a bunch of people up in the normal vision part and enrolled them in this study of this new drug and then looked at them 4 years later? What would you conclude about the drug? Didn't work. Started off with normal vision, you ended with normal vision. More typically, what would happen if anybody in this room got whiff of a new treatment is they'd be lined up outside the study, wanting to get in, and they would be closer to the bottom part of that curve. And if you enrolled somebody at the bottom part of that curve and looked at them 4 years later, what would you conclude about the drug? Didn't work. So what you want to do is you want to know where that curve is, you want to know what age that curve occurs, and you want to design your trial to put it right on that curve, because that's the thing that's going to give you the greatest signal to noise and let you find out that it works with the fewest number of patients in the shortest amount of time. Now, you can do it by just throwing in everybody, and if you have an N of 2,000 and unlimited time, you could eventually find out that it works, but we shouldn't do that because resources are limiting. So we're moving into the last little part now. Here's the model. What we want to do is have a nonprofit center where we just charge an amount of money that it costs us to do the actual physical work of the test. And over the next 5 years, we want to develop what we call a clinically useful test for every inherited eye disease. Clinically useful test for every inherited eye disease. Now, this definition of a clinically useful test is one of the most important things I'll tell you about today. 50% chance of a positive result, easily understood report, 8-week turnaround, less than $500. So that's what we're trying to accomplish for every disease. It's not trivial to do that, but that's just, you have to have a goal, you have to know what you're trying to do, and that's what we're trying to do with the the Carver Laboratory. Now, I'm going to tell you the three things that I learned from the patients now, and I'm going to make a couple of points about this, about what we're doing with the laboratory. There is a story that two or three people here told me. It turned out it was all the same story. Different people were telling me about it, in which recently a young child was diagnosed with a pretty severe condition. Her father arranged to have a blood sample drawn from a knowledgeable clinician, made the right diagnosis, drew the right blood sample, and they sent it to our laboratory. And what do you think, after a few phone calls, what do you think was said about that from the parent who had arranged the blood sample to be sent? So you should know the answer. Just like you knew the answer to "there's nothing we can do." What? Where are the results? And again, see, you're being kind. You know, they say, "We haven't heard anything." Usually with an expletive or two thrown in. They remove the expletives when I'm in the room, but they say the same thing. "We haven't heard anything. We haven't heard anything." Well, you know, if you go investigate that, it turns out that the sample was drawn correctly. The sample was sent. It's a test that takes, 4 to 6 months to do. We've had it for 3 months. And I don't have the person's address because it was sent to me by the doctor. It's not done. But, you know, we've had this explanation too many times. This is a problem. We don't want people out there feeling that they haven't heard stuff. And what has finally dawned on us, you'd think that some smart people would have dawned on them about, 14.8 years ago instead of taking 15 years of this to figure it out. But patients are accustomed to going to their doctor's office, getting a blood sample drawn, and finding out the result of that blood sample when? An hour later, the next day, we're conditioned to that. Our whole life, we're conditioned to that. So it doesn't matter. You can tell the person, "Oh, it's going to be 6 minutes." I go, "Uh-huh." When do they call the laboratory? 2 weeks. Phone calls start at 2 weeks. And so if you have 46,000 samples in the laboratory collected over the last 20 years, that is a lot of phone calls. So anyway, we thought about that a long time, and we have solved that problem. I am proud to tell you today we solved the problem. I'm going to tell you how it works. And we solved it with the support given to us by the Foundation Fighting Blindness. It's an Amazon.com sample tracking system. Okay? I mean, you think about it. You order your paperback book. Where is it? When's it coming, right? You get on the web and they tell you where it is. It's in some truck in a ditch 200 miles away. You know where it is. Okay, so if you go to the website, which is on the other side of this card, and in the upper right-hand corner of that website, it says, "Check the status of a test." And when you click on that, it takes you to a page, and it says, "Enter your specific patient number in there." And then it'll go and tell you, we have your sample. We received it on such and such a date. It came from such and such a doctor, and this is its status. It's been reported. It hasn't been, and whatever. And then below that it says, "What if you don't have a number?" Well, there are a lot of people that don't have a number because we just dreamed this up. See, so I don't have a number yet. But you click on the thing that says, "Suppose I've lost my number," and it goes to a form. And you type in your name and your email address and about when you sent your sample and what your diagnosis is and everything. And then at the end of the day, we can gather up 20 of these and go rummage around and find the answer to all that stuff. Send you the answer back electronically and the number so that henceforth, whenever you want, you can just get on the web and check that thing. Okay? And every new sample we ever obtain is going to give one of these number things out. So we don't have to be talking about this "where is my sample" thing anymore. And I know you'll be happy about that, and we'll be happy about that. We may be happier than you, actually. Now, here's the secret weapon. Here's the secret weapon thing. I know you've been waiting for that. I've been hinting around about this for 2 days. What if I told you that we had the ability to increase the efficiency of a test 20-fold, 20-fold of a genetic test? What kind of technology do you think that would be? Is that an instrument doing that? A new reagent?
It's the function of numbers.
It's what? Economy of scale? Is that what you're thinking? Like just having more of it to do? Well, no is the answer to that question. That's not what it is. So I was talking to a person, and this person was telling me about their family history and so forth. And he said, well, how much is it going to cost, you know, if I just ponied up all the money you needed right now to screen all the RP genes that are known to find my disease, you know, what's the total drive out price of that, you know? And that's a big number. That is a hard thing to do. But I get to talking to this person, and I'm pretty sure that this person has X-linked retinitis pigmentosa. I just ask him two or three questions, and I'm pretty sure he's got X-linked retinitis pigmentosa. How many X-linked retinitis pigmentosa genes are there right now? Two. So our problem just went from 40 to 2 with a few minutes of talking to this person. So the secret weapon are the clinicians. That's the secret weapon, the clinicians. Okay? We have to go out there into our training programs all across the country, and instead of sending these guys down to the next FACO course or something, we need to teach them some more about these diseases, make them realize there is something we can do. And if you learn about these diseases like you learned about the other ones, you can recognize from a few questions and the way the retina looks and whatever, which group of diseases that you're thinking about testing. And that focuses the testing effort between 20-fold and 1,000-fold. I mean, there are some diseases that you can look at and there is one nucleotide in the entire genome that has ever been shown to cause that disease. And it's a 50-cent test if you know that clinically. So the secret weapon is not a new ABI sequencer or any type of platform. It is getting these tests into the hands of doctors and training a new generation of ophthalmologists how to do this. And the last example I'm going to tell you, similar thing, talking to a family and whatever. And in the course of interacting with my laboratory, in the clinical diagnosis box on the form had been written autosomal dominant retinitis pigmentosa when this patient had autosomal recessive retinitis pigmentosa. And so he got a report back saying the test was negative and so forth, but down in the clinical diagnosis box it said autosomal dominant. Well, that would be concerning to you if you got that in the mail, that there was this disagreement with what you thought and so forth. And so what that's an example of is that there is no substitute for this interaction like is going on at this meeting. There is no substitute for that. If we've got some little box, so what had happened? The doctor had sent in the test with no inheritance pattern written in to screen for dominant RP genes. And so the person filling out the form made the assumption that because the doctor was ordering dominant RP stuff on this patient, it was dominant RP. That was an error. But when we have an error like that and we learn from it, then we can put mechanisms in place where 852 other people won't have that experience. So I guess what I'm trying to convey to you today is I don't think genetic testing is a technical problem anymore. I think there's better stuff we can do technically. It'll get cheaper, it'll get faster, it'll get better. It has become a communication problem. And so the other card that's out there next to that, there's something we can do card. Discriminate this condition from that condition, you know, because that's what you really want to know, right? Those two things. And there are whole textbooks that are written like that. But you're exactly right. But in my view, it needs to be coupled. It needs to be coupled with the genotypes. And so, if you're at the University of Iowa and you're a second-year resident, and I show you a picture of Malathion 11 tenazi, I say, "So, what gene would you screen this patient for? And there's some visiting guy there doing a rotation or something. And he laughs like I'm joking. And the second year resident says, EFEMP1. And the guy's stunned. You can learn that just like you can learn anything else, but it has to be integrated into your training. So I think what's missing right now is that a few centers are able to do this because they have researchers that do it, but every center that's training the ophthalmologist isn't doing this. And we got to get it out there in their hands so that that's just embedded in our diagnostic thought. And then that thing you're suggesting is going to be true.
Hold on.
I can. Okay.
I'm sorry. I was wondering about another possible use of this data bank that you mentioned, and that's that when, say, a treatment is developed, whether you would then notify people who you've identified as having the appropriate.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. I should have mentioned that myself. You see, what I think is true, our whole system is a patient-centered system. So in other words, if you or your child has RPE65-associated Leber's congenital amaurosis, I want you to know that. I want you to be holding a sheet of paper in your hands. Now, we might and should put on our website every trial that we know that's existing, and the FFB should put that on there. But once you know that it's RPE65 that you have, you can go to Google and type that in, and if there's somebody in a basement someplace with some trial, you're not dependent upon me to put you in contact with it. See, it empowers the patient to make the decisions by putting that diagnosis in their hand. Now, of course, the individual clinicians who are interested in this, if they have 15 patients with RPE-associated Leber's congenital amaurosis that they care for, they're going to be, you know, when they find out about the trial, they're going to be calling those people up and so forth. But it creates a two-tier system where you don't require your physician to be the gatekeeper to help direct you to something, because the mutation becomes the universal language.
Also, the foundation is keeping our fingers on the pulse of what is going on in the community, and we're putting on our website when trials start.
I was thinking about the step after the trial, when it goes into treatment, it's available for treatment. Would you then notify the patients that the trial was successful and so on?
Oh, sure. So the point being made is, after the trial, I can guarantee you that the day somebody treats a child, a blind child, and that child sees, you are not going to need any form of electronic communication to find out about that result. You're just going to hear the roar go across this United States.
I wonder if there's a mechanism for storing through this system the DNA, because particularly for the recessive disorders where the gene might not have been identified early on with testing, is there a mechanism as new genes are identified to go back and look at those samples rather than patients knowing that they need to go back in and get retested?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question. The samples are stored. I have every sample that I've collected. That's how we have 46,000 of them. Dr. Dager has gazillions of samples in his laboratory. Let me tell you the two features of this thing that you're asking about, which are so great. The first is, let's just use LCA again because we're talking about that. We currently have about a 50% chance of finding the genetic cause of a patient with Leber's congenital amaurosis that walks in the door. So let's say that we had 1,000 families like that, and we studied that 1,000 families and found the 500 that had mutations. The 500 that didn't have mutations then becomes 100% better for a gene discovery effort than it was before. Anything you do to that sample looking for a new gene just got half as expensive, twice as fast, any way you want to look at it, because if you've got all these known genes in there, it's just slowing you down. So the truth of the matter is, what we see this high-throughput, nonprofit genetic testing lab thing is the front end of the research process. And we've got some mechanisms that I won't go into today whereby if a physician in state A is collaborating with a scientist in state B and has for years to do gene discovery, That sample can go through our laboratory to the research scientist. If we find the mutation in a known gene, most of the time that would be the end of the story. Sometimes the scientists would still want it because they'd look for mitigator genes or something like that. But in any way, if we're doing this in a high volume way, we can do that testing for known genes less expensively than most independent research labs could do. They would need to do it anyway when it got to their lab for this enrichment purpose that I just said. So my point is that absolutely, that's what I meant about the 90%. We want to bust those 90% people loose. We want those samples in research laboratories. But this genetic testing initiative I'm talking about is not that. It's the thing that enables that. It's the thing that encourages the samples out from under the woodwork, removes the known mutations from it, and gives us enriched uranium to the scientific community to do their gene discovery work.
Okay, I have had a similar question. How, if you get a blood sample from sent by a doctor, how long, and if you don't find anything, I mean, I'm here, I've got actually test results from that were sent to you, dating back to 2000, to the year 2000.
Glad there's no alcohol involved.
So I see that the first test was DNA. The second one, a year later, was ABS test. These are the tests I think that were run, that they were run on the blood.
But what's your specific question?
First of all, how long is the shelf life of the blood sample?
The great thing about DNA and the reason nature chose it as the genetic material is that you can dig it up out of a peat bog 50,000 years later and PCR it.
Okay,
so the samples, I tell this story a lot. I told this to Gordon last night. About once a month, we find a mutation in somebody's sample that we drew in 1987. Uh-huh. And then we track them down using Google phone book or something, you know, get this person on the phone because they've long since left Iowa for a better job. And so we get them on the phone and we sort of explain, you know, this Dr. Stone, and they go, after this pause, they go, "You? I thought you were dead." Yeah. And many people in the room will, you know, understand that comment, you know, because they think we're dead with respect to their sample. But the sample lasts forever if properly handled. You can do thousands of tests on a single sample. The second part of your question, which is how long does it take? This is just frankly a mistake that we made, you know, in our ignorance. You've heard various scientists today fess up to their ignorance of what they were doing 10 years ago. We thought that gene therapy was going to be easier than it was, you know, so we were kind of over suggesting things and whatever. Well, the mistake we made back in the rhodopsin era, when we had a total of 30 samples in the laboratory and one gene to look at, is we told people, well, you know, we're just going to keep looking, and whenever we find something, we'll call you, which would have been possible with 30 samples, and it is not possible with 46,000 samples. So really what we need to do is we need to have two kinds of tests. We need to have some kind of test that we're going to do pretty much right now with technology we have right now, and you and I need to understand whatever it is we're going to test. And it needs to be described on the website, and you know what we're going to do, and that costs $481, and we're going to do it, and we're going to give you an answer. And then if negative, that needs to go over into a research box in our laboratory or Steve Dager's laboratory or something else, and that thing needs to have the Amazon.com number on it so that every once in a while you can check in and see how that research project's going.
So will it be used then to have other genes checked?
It will be if that's your choice. So some people will choose to get one thing tested, and they'll say, that's all I want, and other people will want to enroll their sample in some scientist's laboratory for further testing. It's for the patient to say. It's the patient's decision what they want to do.
And I want to put out that we at the foundation have put together a packet on genetic testing, which includes a number of questions and answers. If you go to your doctor, we have a letter for the doctor explaining what genetic testing is. We have sample forms. We've heard the call from people saying, what is it? How does it operate? I've been to the doctor. They don't know what I'm talking about. So that's available on our website for downloading. So it's question, how long does it take? We consulted with a lot of the geneticists in this room and laboratories and came up with the answers that are in this document. It's not tomorrow. It's not 2 weeks. it's X amount of time for this and it's X amount of time for that.
And that'll get better as the technology gets better.
Do we have any idea, do you have any idea, over here.
Sorry.
Where is do you it? Have any idea as to the number of genetic defects that you've found or genes that you have found as it relates to RP and particularly recessive RP?
Well, recessive RP is the hardest challenge because it is the most heterogeneous, that is the most number of different genes cause recessive RP. Something on the order of at least 40 known genes, and if you look with certain statistical approaches, one can argue that there will ultimately be about 100 genes. Some of these genes are huge, enormous, and so that has been really, really daunting. However, we're really excited, and I think some other groups are really excited about the application of newer, higher throughput methods for looking at these, and I think you're going to see in the next 12 to 18 months the needle moving on the autosomal recessive channel for the first time in a long time. And I can tell you everybody in our laboratory is looking forward to that day because, you know, it's sort of been a whistling by the graveyard thing. We go into this box and we know that 70% of the samples in that box are recessive RP, and we've got a really poor track record in finding mutations there. And so although it's been great that we've been doing good work with best disease and X-linked RP and dominant RP and so forth, that recessive RP remains sort of, in my view, the holy grail of genetic testing. And, you know, let's have this conversation a year from now and see how we're doing.
Steve, mine is just really two quick questions, one to you and one to Ed. And number one is the packets that you discuss, that you make, that you have out here, would various chapters be allowed to give those out to ophthalmologists in the communities they live near or in? And to you, Ed, how are you going to get the word out to all ophthalmological community?
I'm so glad
what
you
you're going to do.
Let Steve answer, and then I'll give you the cool answer to that.
The answer, Luli, is yes. In fact, we, as part of our program, we want to disseminate those packets out. The development group has them, and we're putting them into as many offices that we know about and can get them into, without a doubt. So if anybody wants to take them and put them into your local offices and let your physicians know, we put it together strictly for total dissemination throughout.
They're on our website.
Right, they're on the website. Now, they can be downloaded.
Now, in answer to your question, Luli, I've been pretty hard on the ophthalmologists in my talk today, characterized them as being not that, and I can say this because I am an ophthalmologist, but I've been pretty hard on them, you know, not saying the right thing and not knowing the right thing and whatever. But what do you think the likelihood that this group of incredibly busy people that are for the most part surgeons, who for the most part were trained before the first one of these genes was discovered, that they are suddenly going to become enlightened about this technology and start just burning up the Ethernet cables into our laboratory, ordering these packets by the gross? Are you? No, I see heads out here. People are not going for that. And so those among you might say, well, gee, that's a pretty fatal flaw for your plan there, Ed. I mean, it's all great to have this product that nobody's going to buy. And I must admit, I was pretty worried about that and didn't exactly know what to do, as I have been several times in my career thinking I would think of it like Tara, you know, like Scarlett O'Hara, you know, I'm going to think about that tomorrow. Okay, and of course, like everything else, the answer was in the hands of the patients. They will tell you if you ever want to know the answer to one of these things, you just ask the patients. So the secret weapon for this is this. Okay? So I'm going to tell you a true story. In the last few months, this lady, LCA again, I actually do see patients with diseases other than LCA, but it just makes for a good example because it's just such a devastating problem for a family to cope with. So this lady went into a local doctor and said she didn't think her baby could see. And this doctor got all a Twitter and said he'd never heard of anything like that, never seen anything like that, and he believed he needed to put that baby to sleep and get a CAT scan. And so the mom thought about this general anesthesia and, you know, the cost of it and the risk to her baby and all that stuff. And you know, she worked in the post office or something. I mean, she was not a scientist. She was just a rank and file person out there. And so she went home and got on her computer and cruised around a little bit on the computer with the symptoms that her child had and diagnosed her baby with Leber's congenital amaurosis based on the descriptions of the disease on the web. So she just read around. She decided that. So she navigated her way over to our website and discovered we had a test for this for $494. And she sent me an email at 11 o'clock at night that I happened to be up working on something, and I got that email, and she asked if we could do that, and I said yes. And so she trooped back over to her doctor and said, I think my baby's got Leber's congenital amaurosis, and I want you to order a test for it. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, what do you mean Leber's congenital amaurosis, you know? There are no tests for Leber's congenital amaurosis. Well, I have this PDF file right here that I just printed out. And this little argument went on for a while. And the sample came in, and 10 weeks later, we had found both mutations. This lady diagnosed her own child, printed this thing out on a dot matrix printer, and went in there and educated that guy. Okay? And that's the answer to how this is going to work.
I've been diagnosed with Stargardt's disease. I went to UCLA for a while. I've got a blood test. I think I sent it to your lab. And
I think it's time for a break.
Okay, but on that curve thing that you're talking about, yes. You could say that I'm part of the downcrease part. So what could you do for me right now to, like, stop it? Is there anything that you have available?
Well, this is an excellent question. And you see, the point I was trying to make about that mortar in between the bricks thing is that the genetic test per se does not treat the patient. But what the genetic test could do is could identify some known variations in the ABCA4 gene so that the scientists doing one of those drug trials that you heard Tim talk about in his talk, they're going to say, okay, we're going to do this thing now. We're going to do this Cytera thing or one of these other drugs. We need to go get 50 people or whatever and give us 50 people that have bona fide changes in the ABCA4 gene. And by knowing, you know, what you've got, I believe that that is going to help entry into the trial. When you're in the trial, it's going to help the design of the trial and the analysis of the data to know the natural histories associated with the different changes in the different genes and so forth. So I think that that's my point, is that the genetic testing isn't the whole answer. It's the part that connects the other answers together and makes them more effective.
All right. I think it's time to do the break for the Meet the Docs. I want to thank everybody. Thank you, Ed, very, very much. Thank you, Tim.